Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. The coronavirus pandemic has upended everyone's lives, but it's been especially disappointing for high school seniors.
We didn't even get like a proper goodbye, really, from this place that we spent major parts of our lives.
With casinos closed and oil and gas revenues stalled, the Wind River Reservation is facing tough economic times.
It's a double whammy for the tribes here in Wyoming, because those two sectors are the brunt of what we rely on to run our tribal government.
Speaking of that, Douglas was booming, but the crash in crude demand has caused it to empty out. Businesses across the area are reeling.
Yeah, about 5 weeks ago, it was just like somebody flipped the switch and the phone never rang.
Join us for those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. This is a tough financial time for a lot of Wyomingites, but impacts on the general public also impact funding for local governments, which directly impacts a wide variety of services from law enforcement to streets. Laramie City Manager Janine Jordan is used to worrying about money. The University of Wyoming is the community's largest employer, but UW is tax exempt. That means it doesn't pay property or sales taxes. How does that impact the bottom line? The State Division of Economic Analysis says Albany County's assessed valuation or property tax revenue for roughly 40,000 people is about $430 million. Campbell County is slightly bigger, but its assessed valuation is over $4 billion. That makes sales tax a pretty big deal in Laramie. And Jordan says after a pretty good year, the community finally got its revenue back up to pre-Great Recession levels. Then COVID-19 hit.
We've reached out not only to our local economic development partners, which would be the Laramie Chamber Business Alliance and the Laramie Main Street Alliance, to ask what they're seeing. And they've shared anecdotal observations that business activity in Laramie is down somewhere between 50 and 70%.
One thing that really hurt Laramie is the university asked students not to return after spring break.
So our customer base is down dramatically, and then layering on top of that these business closures. But it's kind of a double whammy effect.
Cody Mayor Matt Hall certainly understands. In his town, sales tax revenue was up 9% in early 2020. Then COVID-19 hit there. Yellowstone National Park then closed, and things no longer look rosy.
So it's going to be pretty dicey to see what we end up being faced with.
The governor wants tourism to get rolling in the next week or so, but Hall knows there will be an impact in travel this year. He says luckily they go into the summer with a bit of a buffer.
We've got a decent reserve right now. You know, I could definitely see us probably tapping into that, you know, much more than, you know, we would have expected we would have been had to. But there again, that's why you generate those reserves for, well, situations just like this, right?
It's hard to say how long the impacts will be, but Jeremiah Riemann of the Wyoming County Commissioners Association says the early returns on sales tax losses haven't been good.
In some areas, it's as high as 20%, and counties are beginning to budget around the idea that they may see a reduction of 20 to 25% in sales and use tax.
But counties are even more worried about property tax declines and whether or not those in the energy industry will be able to pay their taxes. That could mean a loss of millions, especially in years to come. Riemann, in the meantime, has been lobbying legislators and the governor for help from the Federal CARES Act to help local government. One proposal would provide $70 million through a formula, which could mean some minor relief. The governor has a plan that could put $300 million into the mix. The problem is the federal government might not agree this is a legal way of distributing the money. But if it works, Riemann says that would go a long way towards addressing the hundreds of million dollars in projected losses to local governments.
To kind of play it that way, we're getting closer to being able to cover the potential revenue impacts that they've analyzed.
Laramie City Manager Janine Jordan is nervous about the fall.
if we move into the fall, then we see impacts to students returning to sports and fall activities at the university. That could be really significant.
That's why Jordan and other government officials plan on retooling their budgets this fall after they get a better sense of what the actual impacts will be. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck. The Wind River Reservation has been hit hard by COVID-19. The pandemic has also stalled the Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho tribes' primary economic engines. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr reports on what that means for the reservation and its border communities.
The largest employer in Fremont County isn't a school district or a hospital. It's the Northern Arapaho tribe. Business councilman Stephen Fasthorse says that between the tribal government and its enterprises, they put more than 1,000 people to work.
We're a very vital piece of this economy.
But the COVID-19 pandemic has thrown a wrench in that. First, it forced them to close their flagship Wind River Casino and two smaller gaming businesses. Then oil and gas revenues went south.
It's a double whammy for the tribes here in Wyoming because those two sectors are the brunt of what we rely on to run our tribal government.
And the Eastern Shoshone could be in an even tougher position.
And unfortunately for our casino, it's kind of been insult to injury.
Councilwoman Karen Snyder says the Shoshone Rose Casino is self-sustaining, but the tribe hasn't yet paid off the loan that funded a $30 million expansion of the facility 5 years ago.
Not only are we struggling to keep afloat with our loan, now we have closure.
So both tribes' primary sources of revenue have been cut off. And unlike state and local governments, they don't have a tax base to fall back on. Joseph Kalt, with Harvard's Project on American Indian Economic Development, says the budget crisis they're facing isn't unique.
We're seeing tribes either having to dip into some assets, rainy day funds, if they've been able to build them up over the last many years, or tribes are going into debt. It's a really drastic situation.
Kalt says tribes have been running serious gaming operations since the 1970s, and that's allowed them to diversify their economies.
As a result of that, we've seen a massive expansion across the country in the ability of tribes' governments to deliver the whole range of basic public services that we expect any city, county, or state to provide.
Like the Northern Arapaho Tribe's clinic, where more than 3,000 people have been tested for COVID-19, and the Eastern Shoshone Tribal Health Department, which is running food and supply distributions throughout the reservation during the crisis. But with the revenue stream cut off, those services are in trouble.
We run a risk, essentially, of reversing what's been about 30 years of slow but at least steady progress.
And Kalt says the impact will have ripple effects far beyond the reservation. His research models suggest that the tribes generate around $12 million a year in indirect revenue to the state of Wyoming.
Many regions, Riverton, Wyoming, for example, depend a great deal on the money that's flowing in through that community because of the presence of the tribe, its government, its enterprises. And so we would really be worrying about places like that suffering a kind of long, drawn-out recession in their economies.
To make matters worse, tribes and tribal gaming businesses were initially shut out of the federal Paycheck Protection Program, which provides forgivable loans to businesses impacted by the pandemic. Senator Tom Udall of New Mexico was among lawmakers who pressured the Small Business Administration to include them in round two of the program.
Tribal gaming enterprises are some of the biggest employers. They fund essential services in Indian country, things like health care, education, public safety, law enforcement. Unfortunately, it took the SBA far too long to make this right.
Councilwoman Snyder says the Eastern Shoshone were among those tribes who were initially denied loans. That led to layoffs for casino employees and other consequences for government workers.
You know, we've had to look at some potential furloughs. We have reduced hours for some of our tribal workers, and that means interruption of our tribal services.
In early May, she says the tribe and its casino finally received loans from the Small Business Administration.
And so that, to me, initially would be to make the tribe tribe whole again as far as our operations.
And after weeks of back and forth, some aid from the massive federal relief package known as the CARES Act has finally reached tribal governments. But due to pending lawsuits about how the $8 billion Tribal Stabilization Fund should be divided up, the Treasury Department has only released 60% of the money. Northern Arapaho Councilman Fast Horse says all this puts tribes at an early disadvantage.
And this is the trying part for tribes, is that we're always at the last of the line.
It's not yet clear how much federal aid the Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho tribes received, but they're both hoping it's enough to help them bounce back. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Savannah Marr on the Wind River Reservation.
When we come back, we'll hear about how the pandemic is impacting domestic violence in the state. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. For many of us, being asked to stay home during the pandemic is inconvenient. But for others, it is downright dangerous. Wyoming Public Radio's Megan Feary spoke with the executive director of the Fremont County Alliance Against Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, Sydney Allred, who said that social distancing is putting those already living with domestic violence at greater risk.
For a lot of us, home is a safe place. Home is a good place to be, but when you are dealing with domestic violence or child abuse situations, home is the nightmare. There is no one to check the batterer right now. I'm not going to work. My kids aren't going to school. There is no one to see the bruises. And right now, victims are trapped with the monster. And they can't call me. And no one is going to know what's going on in that house.
So who is most at risk right now?
Statistically, men are less likely to be victims. That is the reality. And women and children are at incredibly high risk. I mean, in most cases where there is a batterer who is beating their wife, they're beating their kids. Batterers view their families as property. They're not people. They're not equals. These are monsters. The things that they do, and it's more than just the physical violence. It is what they say. I can fix a broken arm. I can take you to the ER. We can get that handled. I cannot fix the hours of verbal abuse and emotional abuse that you've endured.
And how has law enforcement been responding?
We're not arresting anything unless it is pretty extreme. A lot of these things that would incentivize a batterer to measure himself or herself, they're just not in place right now, and it is really scary. So, for example, I recently had a client who had a protection order in place. Batterer showed up at house, tried to break in, and all law enforcement did was send him away. They didn't arrest him. They cited him, but they didn't arrest him. And I understand it. My husband is a corrections officer.
Why has law enforcement been responding this way?
They're really trying to minimize the number of people coming in and out of the jail, because if we have a breakout in the jail, it would be devastating. I mean, there's not enough corrections officers, so if an entire two shifts get sick and are supposed to be quarantined at home, we don't have enough people to run the jail.
So what options do people and families have who are living in these situations, you know, stuck inside with their batterer?
So we still are providing shelter. Like, if someone isn't safe and they need to get out, we're getting them out. The most dangerous time for a victim is when they're leaving and right after they've left. So we are having to do a lot of very strategic thinking and planning as we are extracting folks, because the world is just upside down right now. One of my favorite tools is a safety word, a code word. Get one with your kid, get one with us. It's a random word, maybe cheeseburger. It would be something that you would never text me or message me. If I see cheeseburger, I'm calling the police and I'm sending them to you right now, because that means your life is at risk. So we are still able to provide almost all of the exact same services that we've always been providing. It just looks a little different.
Now, is it true that domestic violence rates go up in the summer?
The weather gets hot and people get mean. I don't get it, but that's what happens. A major, major increase in the sale of alcohol. And alcohol, while it does not cause domestic violence or child abuse, it escalates it. and the impact that that has on domestic violence, coupled with summer, coupled with kids not being able to be sent to summer sports or activities. People are really going to be in a very tough situation for the foreseeable future.
What do you want people who are not living in this kind of situation to maybe know or think about?
I know what's going on in that house. I know what they're being exposed to and enduring. And that's, I think, part of why I get so worked up and just frustrated with people who are not respecting some of these health and state guidelines, because there are people right now who are having to stay in a place that is the most dangerous place for them. And they are doing it to try to keep other people safe. I can't imagine being a mother trapped with a monster and having to protect my babies and maybe not having access to a phone or not having cell service to even call an agency like ours. And I know how bad it is. Adding a pandemic to domestic violence is, it's a powder keg.
So if someone knows someone who is living with domestic violence, what can they do right now to help?
You can interrupt the violence. Check in as much as possible, because the batterer, again, they're trying to protect a persona and an image. But if I have a phone call that I have scheduled, or a Zoom call, and I like Zoom a lot, or FaceTime or Skype, because the batterer knows I can see him. So that helps to stop what's in progress. If you are worried about somebody, just call people. Call and check in and say, hey, I love you. I care about you. I know this is terrible, but I am here. And then wherever you're at in the state, if you are worried about someone, find that crisis hotline. Every county has a crisis hotline. Find that number. Get that number to your friend.
Is there anything you want to say to those that are living in an abusive household right now? Is there any message you want to get out there?
We are here. You are not alone. We care. And if you need us, find a way. Call us and we will get you out, because you don't have to suffer.
Sydney Allred, thank you so much for speaking with me.
That's Sydney Allred speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Megan Feary. If you or someone you know needs help, resources can be found at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You know, it's no secret that our food supply chain is struggling. As the Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck reports, the federal government is trying to help, but it's complicated.
President Donald Trump announced the Coronavirus Food Assistance Program on April 17th, and Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue was excited.
This program will not only provide direct financial relief to our farmers and ranchers, Mr. President, but will allow for the purchase and distribution of our agricultural abundance in this country to help our fellow Americans in need.
$16 billion will go directly to farmers, ranchers, and producers. $3 billion more will go to buying meat, dairy, and other foods for hunger relief groups like food banks. But there's a couple of caveats. Those checks aren't expected until late May at the earliest, and they're not going to be enough. Later that day, Perdue had this to say on a press call.
We know that the disruption to markets and demand is significant, and these payments will only cover a portion of the impacts on farmers and ranchers.
And the impacts have been huge. Grocery store demand hasn't been enough to replace the income they've lost from restaurants, hotels, and schools that closed down. So they've been dumping their livelihoods down the drain, from mountains of potatoes given away for free to pig farmers aborting piglets because they can't sell to their usual retailers. Chris Deshmaker ranches Black Angus, Red Angus Cross with her family outside of Lewistown, Montana. Before all this, she says they'd already faced a few tough winters.
We're out about 550 head, and we'd like to be at 600 because we're a family-owned operation, and we want to keep our boys on the ranch with us, and we need to expand to do that.
The pandemic has made things worse. Deshmaker says her calves aren't due to be sold until fall, so that's okay for now, but
we still have 30 steers left that we'd like to get rid of that we're probably going to keep and run for yearlings, hoping that keeping them over will give us a better market than what we have right now for that weight of cattle.
Of course, that market depends on meatpacking plants, which are struggling with COVID-19 infections. Ranchers can't sell cattle if people can't get those cows processed into burger and cuts we buy at the store. The federal aid package promised $5.1 billion in direct payments to ranchers, more than for any other profession. Deshmaker says she's looking into federal programs, but
there's no sense in us jumping on a bandwagon until we know which wagon to jump on. Because there's a lot of different programs out there, but not everyone is going to qualify or every program's going to work for whatever operations.
As Deshmaker worries about keeping her cattle operation profitable, food banks are worried about getting that meat, fresh food, and other staples on their shelves. Karen Vauk heads up the Idaho Food Bank.
Typically, we'd be able to pick up food that was available for donation from the stores, and that represented about 35% of our total food distribution.
But big grocery can't help as much anymore because they have their own supply issues.
That food is down significantly. It's down 50 to 60%.
This as more people are flocking to food banks because they lost their job. Vauk says they're trying to keep pace with that demand by purchasing meat and produce, but they have a limited cash flow.
We, in fact, have made the largest purchase of food for the last couple of months in our history. We've never had to spend this much money on food purchase before. But, you know, we got hungry people.
She says one county's food needs even tripled. The USDA's federal aid program plans to help by buying meat and produce and getting it to food banks. And Vauk is excited, especially about meat.
That's always been a challenging product for us to be able to source to the need.
There could be a problem with that, though. There may be extra cows or hogs for the government to buy, but again, with meat plants running into problems, there will be fewer finished products like beef or ham, even with the Trump administration's executive order to keep them open. For now, farmers and ranchers are waiting on more details from that program and that first check. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Madeline Beck.
Coming up, low oil prices are having a huge impact on Douglas. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Not too long ago, the small oil-reliant city of Douglas was booming to the benefit of the state's coffers. But since the oil price crash, it's transformed. Hotels have emptied, projects were left abandoned, and traffic disappeared. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports on how Douglas is handling the change.
The sun is beating down on a nearly empty gravel plot. Just a few weeks ago, trailers owned by oil field and pipeline workers lined this man camp. A mother is packing up her trailer to leave too, as her daughters play nearby. Her family came here so her husband could work on a pipeline.
Yeah, we came here from Oklahoma because, you know, the oil field basically crashed there. So we came down here. I think we've been here since January.
But with the latest oil crash, they're back on the road. Her husband's currently scouting another job in North Dakota. She didn't think they'd be leaving Wyoming so soon.
We didn't really expect it, but that's the oil field.
Converse County is the number one producer of crude oil in Wyoming. The county relies on oil and gas for about 70% of its annual revenue. But with the oil price collapse, the majority of rigs have disappeared, leaving at least 1,700 oil field workers without a job in Wyoming since March 1. Still, at the man camp, County Commissioner Robert Short says it's starting to feel like a ghost town here.
You would normally see probably 30 to 50 semi-trucks with frac sand trailers or, you know, water haulers moving up and down that road during different points of the day. Today, zero.
This drop in all oil field activity has been hard on local businesses. Short owns several himself. He's already had to lay off 13 employees at his hotel restaurant. And it's not just him. As oil prices fall,
so does all of the foundation for the economics in this small community.
Hotels are seeing crews up and leave, forcing layoffs. Supply stores are seeing revenue drop. Mechanics like Fad Alexander are feeling it too. He owns Bud's Field Service and Truck Repair.
Yeah, about 5 weeks ago, it was just like somebody flipped the switch and The phone never rang.
But now his large open-air shop is empty, save for one orange semi-trailer cab left behind for maintenance.
We had some of our longtime customers. They stopped in here one last time and said, yeah, we're going home. We're going to park the truck. And that we had customers that were staying here from all over the United States, and they're just done.
Alexander has already had to lay off the only two employees he had. The shop did qualify for a paycheck protection loan, but there's not much work to be done anymore.
So what does that mean for your bottom line?
There's no bottom to it right now. We probably did $10,000 to $20,000 a week, and we're lucky to do $200, $300 a week now.
Alexander is figuring out how to afford a pre-existing loan on his shop and another for a recently purchased service truck. Landlords are also losing tenants as laid-off oil field and coal workers move to the next job. Ron McNair owns nearly 30 units, plus a construction business. He said renters didn't even tell him they were leaving.
And they normally do, but when their job's done, they're gone. You know, so there's no notice they're moving on.
McNair says the town was packed just a couple months ago, and there were no rental openings. Now, everyone has them. In 2019, Converse County actually saw record property tax valuation. It was raining money, as the county treasurer put it. But County Commissioner Jim Willick says that doesn't necessarily mean record tax collection. That depends on a company's ability to pay and avoid bankruptcy.
We'll get a good handle on, you know, what the company's ability to pay their legitimate tax bill is. Then as you look at the other side of it, 2020 is looking like it's not going to be real good.
To tighten its belt, the county has placed a freeze on hiring, paused construction of new courtrooms and offices, and expects budget cuts to come.
Have we weathered them here in Wyoming and Converse County before? Absolutely. But I don't know if we have weathered a total drawback like this one.
As Willick says, Converse County has had its busts. So once again, it's a waiting game to see how much money the county will receive through taxes and federal aid, and how long it will take for the industry it depends on to rebound, or if some other boom will take its place. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim in Douglas.
The pandemic has highlighted who has support and who doesn't. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen spoke with Wyoming Equality's Sarah Burlingame about what life looks like for many LGBTQ folks across the state. Burlingame says if you've got things like a job, family support, and acceptance in your community, you might be doing okay right now and hunkering down like a lot of your neighbors.
But if you're not, if you're a teenager who's now at home, you know, with their parents who are perhaps violently opposed to your sexuality or your gender expression. If you worked in food service where, you know, your presence as a trans person was just kind of tolerated, you're on the lowest rung of the ladder, right? And those are the folks who don't have that support, who don't have protections. They're the ones who've just been hit the hardest right now. You know, those are the ones that I think, what resources can we get to them? Like, how can we help encourage them to just, you know, hold on, get through this? You know, there's a sunrise on the other side, you know? But there's a little bit of terror behind that because, you know, health disparities are exacerbated by pandemics. And, you know, our Two-Spirit friends on the Wind River Reservation, I mean, you know, it's not a good scene right now. And there's not enough support, there's not enough resources, and we just worry about them. It's definitely given us, like, a resolve, like, when this crisis has passed, just how important it is to fight for policies that bring, you know, that narrow that gap in disparities, to make sure that we pass non-discrimination, that we have job protections, that we have housing protections. You know, that's going to be more important than ever.
So for those people that are feeling those impacts in a really particular way, what kind of resources are available to them? I mean, what does that picture look like in Wyoming?
Yeah, so, I mean, yesterday, a really nice man who happens to be transgender reached out to me. He needed an attorney because as a transgender male in Wyoming, he is kind of, you know, thinking two steps ahead and saying, if he does have to be hospitalized, if he does, you know, get this coronavirus, then he needs some special paperwork from an attorney to make sure that his wife has full privileges of the hospital, you know, so that he has access. Like, that's one of, like, just, like, the little things that I think most people aren't thinking of. And, you know, if you're straight and you're worried about, you know, your vulnerability and if you might be hospitalized, it probably wouldn't occur to you that your neighbor, you know, who's trans or gay, might have some hesitation about what does that look like for me if I have to be hospitalized. I mean, the good news is like hospitals like Cheyenne Regional, like they've really stepped up and they're really working to, you know, come into better compliance with kind of, you know, health equity. And some hospitals around the state are doing that, but not all of them. And so it's just another level of insecurity. You know, Wyoming Equality doesn't do any direct services. You know, we advocate, we help with policy, we help with, you know, community organizing and things, but we're not, you know, a direct services organization. But, and we have a very small crisis fund that's just, you know, if somebody has an emergency, needs some help, you know, it's there to kick in, like, a little bit of money. But we just came out and said, like, we'd like to deplete our emergency, you know, our crisis fund immediately. If you need it, please, you know, ask. We'd like to help. And, I mean, that's the thing about Wyoming, right? Like, whether you're straight or you're a member of the LGBTQ population, you're still a stubborn Wyomingite. And, like, we put it out there in, like, multiple venues, and nobody was asking us. And meanwhile, I was seeing folks that I knew online, like, say, hey, can I do some work for you? Can I do something, like, I need to raise money? And so we would reach out to these people and say, hey, like, we have crisis money for you. Can we give it to you? And every single person I reached out to said, oh, that's for somebody who really needs it. You know, I don't want to take it. You know, I'll figure it out. Like, I'll work with my landlord or I'll, you know, do something. I'm like, no, it's for you. Like, we had to, like, really, like, work to get people to accept it, which, you know, probably shouldn't surprise us. Stubborn Wyomingites. I don't think it matters, like, who you go home and sleep with. Like, at the beginning and the end of the day, you're a Wyomingite, and it's just hard for us to accept help. We're so used to, like, doing it on our own.
Or being the helper.
Oh, yeah. No, every single one of these people, right? Like, they're, and that's what we have to tell them, right? Like, you help everybody. Like, you are so generous. Like, every single person who we have, like, reached out to, like, I know them because they are organizing and giving in their community.
And for folks that hear this and feel like, you know, also feel like, okay, what can I do to help? Do you have any directions or places to point them?
Yeah, I mean, if your town does not have a non-discrimination ordinance, like, get a hold of us. We'd like to help you. If you'd like to help out with a statewide, you know, in the legislature non-discrimination ordinance, contact us, WyomingEquality.org. Find us on Facebook. If you want to be a part of that because you recognize it's important, we'd love to have you. And also just consider yourself formally invited by Sarah Burlingame, the Executive Director of Environment Quality, to go bake a casserole, to drop it off on the doorstep of someone in your community, whether they're lesbian, gay, bisexual, two-spirit, transgender, or just an ally. Make a casserole. Drop it off. Be part of this movement. Yeah, you're invited.
Well, thanks so much for chatting, Sarah. It's always a joy.
Yeah, it's lovely to talk to you too, Maggie.
That was Wyoming State Representative and Executive Director of Wyoming Equality, Sarah Burlingame. Let's talk about wildlife. Dealing with threats to their livestock is part of a rancher's daily life, and one of the hardest threats to deal with is depredation, especially if the animal killing their stock is a protected species. Wyoming Public Radio's Ivy Engel has more about the battle between ranchers and one predator in particular.
Golden eagles can be massive. An adult's wingspan can be almost 7.5 feet wide, and they can weigh up to 15 pounds. And according to wildlife biologist Charles Preston, a longtime eagle researcher, they're incredibly capable hunters.
They have quite a broad diet, very diverse, depending on where they live and what's available. In general, their favored food is about size. It's usually medium-sized mammals. But in addition to that, they certainly can and do take foxes, even carnivores the size of coyotes.
Preston says, for the most part, golden eagle populations in Wyoming are stable or slowly declining. But as people start spreading into the open, rural locations eagles favor, their typical prey species are being pushed out. Preston says a lot of the expansion is being done by ranchers, which means their livestock may start to replace some of the eagles' natural prey.
We find that in most cases where eagles take livestock, at least on a regular basis, it's because their natural prey, native prey, is not available or not abundant, usually due to habitat quality issues. The habitat's just not there supporting the native prey. And, ooh, here's a nice source of food in the form of a sheep or lamb or small calf.
And while that's good news for the eagles, it's not so great news for the ranchers. Brandy Forgy owns Forgy Land and Livestock with her husband, Keith. They raise Angus cattle and two different kinds of sheep. The Forgies have about 2,400 sheep, and each year their ewes give birth to about 2,100 lambs. But Brandy estimates they lose at least 150 to 250 each year to predators. And she says the worst depredation is on their lambs.
It could be any of them. I mean, some people have trouble with their calves or whatever. For us, mainly it's lambs. We get a few ewes, yearlings once in a while, but definitely lambs with the eagles and the coyotes. And so I'd definitely say it's mainly the lambs where we have our biggest problem.
But golden eagles are a protected species, and they're not just protected, they're covered by two laws, the Migratory Bird Act and the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act. This means that the Forgies or any other rancher can't kill them to protect their stock. They can't even scare the birds off. They need a special hazing permit for that.
So if we're having trouble, say, I'm just using us as an example. If we're having a lot of trouble with eagles, and a lot of times it's more golden eagles, then you can get a permit to kind of harass them a little bit, like loud noises and whatnot.
A different permit allows falconers to remove golden eagles for ranchers, but the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service only lets 6 eagles in the entire country to be taken from the wild each year for falconry. Trapped goldens can also be relocated, but they often find their way back or start causing issues for other ranchers. Mike Foster is the state director for the USDA Wildlife Services Program. His office is the one ranchers call if they have a predator problem. He speculates that they don't get as many calls about eagle depredation as is actually happening.
Why call and have it documented if there's nothing you can do? And then I think that a lot of ranchers, frankly, don't even know that there's an option out there. They know that eagles are protected. They don't know of anything they can do, and so they don't call.
Foster says the best way ranchers can increase their chances of getting one of those permits is to document the cause of all depredation. But when most herds are in large pastures and scavengers are abundant, proper documentation can be difficult.
And that's one of the challenges that ranchers have, is finding these kills out on a large landscape like we have in Wyoming, finding them in time so that they can call us Wildlife Services, and we can get out there and investigate it before a coyote comes along and finishes eating it or something like that.
Foster says another option for ranchers is a small pot of money offered by Farm Services to compensate for eagle losses. While eagles are usually responsible for a small percentage of all depredation ranchers deal with, they tend to target ranchers for several years in a row, which can cause major losses in the long run. In other words, it's a problem without a good solution. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Ivy Engel.
When we come back, we will hear from a number of high school seniors who are mourning their final year in school. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. The coronavirus pandemic has upended everyone's lives, but as Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler found out, for high school seniors across the state, it's been especially impactful. She collected their voices and brings us this collage.
It's going to be crazy to be able to say, like, for the rest of my life that my senior year got cut short due to a global pandemic.
It still feels surreal. I haven't really accepted the fact, but sometimes it'll hit me.
It's not really your normal experience you have when you're a senior in high school.
There's just going to be always that piece missing from our lives that we didn't get
any closure from, like, a funeral. We didn't get to go through the whole grieving process. It was just kind of like everything stopped so abruptly, and now you have to adjust and keep going.
I'm kind of missing the normal things, because for the longest time I thought, you know, I don't really like school, but now it's your senior year, you know.
Most of my sadness just comes from, like, not getting to say goodbye to people. I've never been the sort of person who's, like, super attached to doing all of the things in high school, I guess. I'm just more upset about just the people.
I have a friend that we have our little desks in the library, and I really just miss that, because that was our spot.
A lot of the kids in my class who really, I don't want to say despise going to school, but we're definitely getting the senioritis. They're some of the most outspoken people about how much they miss it.
Like, I miss going through the halls and secretly judging people, but, like, also being their friends. Like, you always have those people that block the hallways, and you're just like, oh my gosh, why are you in the middle of the hallway? I'm trying to get to class. I miss that.
There's kind of like a checklist that you have as a senior that you see all of the other seniors do. And we've gotten to check off everything as we've gone, like homecoming, last game, basketball, the last basketball game and all that. And then to have that checklist just like cut off.
I'm not usually a super sentimental person, but senior prom's kind of a big deal.
Prom.
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 I bought a dress 4 days before they put us into quarantine. No returns, no refunds, no nothing, so I was a little agitated.
I was actually about to ask my date the Wednesday after everything got canceled, so I was going to get on their school announcements, which I think would have been fun, but
I decided to go all out too, because it was senior year, so I was like, okay, it's blue. And then the back, like, V's down, and then the holes, it's just, like, flowy on the bottom.
We do go through 12 years just continuously working hard and stuff, and I guess it's just a little celebration, a little last hurrah.
Sports and those clubs were the only way that I could get social time since I chose to go online. We finally made it to Nationals in Texas, and that was supposed to be at the end of March,
and that got canceled. And so I played my last hockey games without knowing it.
We were on our way to state. We were a little bit out of Shoshone on our way to Casper, trying to get another state championship, try to be back to back when we heard the news. Like, I wasn't really like sad or like upset. I was just like more like shocked, like, damn, like actually happening.
WHSAA announced that track season, actually all spring sports, were closed for this year.
It was really kind of disheartening for, I think, for the, like, everything I've been working for to kind of get thrown away almost.
They turned on the soccer lights and like I was parked there and like standing, and like I could imagine myself all those years playing soccer.
I did cry because it's just like kind of pulled from you. And my dad always told me, play this game as if it was your last. And I always brushed it off because I was like, oh, I have state, I have nationals, I have all these things. And he was so right. It feels like when I move on to college, I didn't close that chapter of my life properly.
I'm also really going to miss our band and choir performances. And our spring musical was also lost because of this.
We had the costumes rented. We were going to go and get them after spring break, actually. And we had just finished blocking Act 1.
I don't get to participate in senior skip day or senior prank.
I was really looking forward to the senior prank personally, only because, like, I've been pranked every time, and then this is my one chance to get back at everybody.
And we had a whole bunch of them planned out, like dragging all the desks out into the parking lot.
I was going to hire a band to follow around our head track coach for a day, because I knew that would be the most annoying thing, but now I can't, so.
The last day of school that we had, I don't think any of us realized, you know, this might be the last time that I'm ever gonna see some of my classmates in my life.
That was my exact thoughts, actually. My last track practice, my last hangout with friends, lunch with friends, the last day of school, we didn't think that could have been my last day, and that's not how I want us to end.
We didn't even get like a proper goodbye, really, from this place that we spent four of our like major parts of our lives.
What I'm gonna really miss the most about this is that last day of school and knowing, being cognizant of the fact that this is my last day of high school. Being able to relish in the fact that I've completed it, like I'm done, you know?
There's a lot of things that happen in high school that aren't guaranteed, but growing up, graduation is supposed to be the easier part. It's one of the things you work towards because you don't think there's any possibility that it'll get changed.
There's just something about like graduation and physically like walking and watching your friends and all that, so.
And when we're finally like so close to getting it, that it might be taken away from us, it is the hardest thing to know. And so many people have told us, it's just walking across the stage, and I'm just sitting here like, it's really not.
I keep seeing posts on Facebook about how we should just have like drive-through graduation, and I'm like, I don't want something special. I want what everyone else has gotten, because I've wanted this since I was in like kindergarten.
I'm just glad that we're getting one still, because it was something like we've all been looking forward to. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
This experience has really taught me that nothing is guaranteed and that I need to stop taking moments for granted. I honestly don't even really remember my last band concert because I didn't appreciate it as much as I thought I should have. I don't think I appreciated all of those amazing moments enough.
This whole pandemic is kind of an eye-opener to see how fortunate we are to live our busy lives. For me, before I was complaining about school, complaining about all the sports I had, and now I'd give anything to get my life back to normal.
I'd honestly rather it shook out as having social distancing implemented in order to minimize the effects of the pandemic. So it's one of those where it'll be frustrating to have not had some of those experiences, but in the context of everything, I'm okay staying home so less people have a chance of, you know, dying.
And it's kind of like the biggest thing that's happened in my age group's lives. Because, like, I wasn't alive when 9/11 happened, so I don't remember that. And I don't remember the impacts of it, because I was kind of just raised in the impacts of it. And I have a feeling that this is gonna like have impacts that are as big as 9/11.
We're all in the same boat, but we're not all a part of the same storm. There are definitely people out there who have it way worse than just a senior who's not gonna experience his high school prom.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. You can hear the entire show or individual segments on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. We also post our stories on Facebook, Twitter, or you can listen to our Open Spaces podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. We enjoy hearing your suggestions for stories and interviews. You can suggest those via the website as well. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.